the final argument for this term is Capital Motors versus First Indemnity Company versus William Scheid. Ms. Pat Myers, an attorney from Rapid City, apparently on blizzard days out in Rapid, we call Rapid City Bar, and represents the appellant, and Mr. McKnight will probably have an easy time getting home. Attorney from Sioux Falls representing the appellee. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed in his place the Honorable John Erickson from Huron, South Dakota, judge in the Third Judicial Circuit. Ms. Myers, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patricia Myers, and I represent William Scheid, the claimant and the appellant in this case. Mr. Scheid sustained an injury to his non-dominant hand, his left hand, in 1999 while working for Capital Motors. At the time, he was a line mechanic and was earning $14.24 per hour. At the time, the maximum comp rate was $408 a week. His actual weekly pay would have been $477. So starting out, Mr. Scheid is already taking a loss by having the work injury. He could return to light duty work by September of 1999. However, the employer did not have any light duty work for him at the time. There are only two possible positions with employer at the time that Mr. Scheid could work at that would be consistent with his restrictions. That would be one position was of the lot manager, which job was never offered to him, and the other was for a service writer. At the time that Mr. Scheid was available to return to work at Capital Motors, he inquired several times about returning to work at Capital Motors. However, at the time, the service writer job only paid $7.50 per hour, which was significantly less than even his compensation rate of $408 per week. By January of 2000, the service writer job was open again and was open two more times after that. There's no evidence in the record that the service writer job was ever offered to Mr. Scheid in a firm way, nor that when it was offered to Mr. Scheid that it paid comparable to his compensation rate. Claimant accepted some employment from the Bullwag Farms in approximately January of 2000. This job paid $1,500 per month with a year-end bonus of $1,200, which gave him wages of $19,200 per year, or worked out to an average weekly wage of about $39 less than his compensation rate of $408. In February of 2000, the employer insurer's rehabilitation consultant provided the claimant with several other job leads, one of which was a job or a position with Morris Construction for a night supervisor or night manager of some sort. This did require some managerial skills. The claimant did contact the employer about that possible employment, but did not believe he was qualified for that employment. At one point, when the service writer job came open, the position availability was communicated to the claimant through his girlfriend, but the wage was not discussed with the girlfriend or conveyed to the claimant. After two hearings, the Department of Labor found that the claimant was permanently and totally disabled under our
statutes. Was there any evidence that this job offer, or does your client admit that he was aware of this offer through his girlfriend?
He admits that he was aware of the job offer through his girlfriend. However, he denies that any communication was made that, number one, he would be offered the position, and number two, what the pay would be for that position. So he made the assumption that the pay would be similar to what it had been originally, which was about $7.50 per hour, even though their pay structure had changed at that time. After two hearings, the Department of Labor found that Mr. Scheid was permanently and totally disabled under our statutes, that he was unable to find substantial and suitable and gainful employment, and found that he was permanently and totally disabled. The employer and insurer appealed that decision, and Judge Jim Anderson affirmed the Department of Labor's finding that Mr. Scheid was permanently and totally disabled, but ruled that the claimant, because he was working, was entitled only to the supplemental wage benefit under 62-7-41 for any difference between his compensation rate and his current wages, which, as I indicated, was approximately at that time $39 per month. So that would give the claimant at that point $39 per month plus the little 25% incentive to return to work provided for in that statute.
Was that addressed in the appeal, and was that at the request of Capital Motors?
Yes, it was. You mean to Judge Anderson?
Yes.
Yes, that was an issue raised both to the department and to Judge Anderson, as I understand it. The lawyer appealed the department's decision.
Okay, and the department, of course, rejected that, and then and then the trial court reversed as a matter of law. That it was a matter of law.
The trial court held as a matter of law, right, that 62741 would apply. The problem with this ruling is that, and if I may, this is the
part of... Before you get there, so then he would be being paid, what, $408 per week, his workman's comp amount, plus then how much when you figure that formula you just stated?
Because he was making $39 less, the employer insurer would pay him $39 plus a 25% return to work, as I understand it, incentive. As I understand it, that would be 25%
okay, so he
of
would
the
not
$39.
Only be, he would not only be made whole by the $39, but then he'd get a 25% work incentive bonus.
That's my understanding of how the statute works.
Okay.
Does that have an end time to it or a review of some sort, since it was under the rehabilitation statute? Was that in the order?
That was not in the order. Actually, what Judge Anderson held and what he said was that claimant doesn't have to go back to work. If claimant chooses not to work, employer insurer, you're going to pay him the $408. But if claimant decides or chooses to work, even though under our definition it's not suitable, substantial, and gainful employment, we're going to give the employer the and insurer the offset for those wages. So, if I may, this was the part of Judge Anderson's ruling that we appealed from. Judge Anderson affirmed, in fact, that Mr. Scheid was permanently and totally disabled and didn't even really accept argument on that issue, but then he ruled that Mr. Scheid, because he had gone back to work, was not entitled to his full workers' compensation benefits under these under 62.452 and 62.53, which are is our statute, which defines what a permanent total disability means.
Isn't he actually getting a windfall under your argument? Under your argument, he'd be paid the full amount of workman's comp plus he'd get the full amount of his salary, which is only $39 less per month than the $408.
Well, Your Honor, it's a very attractive argument. I understand that. And it does appear that he's getting a windfall. But if you look at the overall compensation scheme, initially the employee is only recovering 66 2/3 of his original wage. Plus, the employee here, Mr. Scheid, is being compensated for not his actual loss of wage under our statutes, but his loss of earning capacity. He is now precluded from all the jobs that the department said he can no longer have. He is now limited to, as they say, what is available to the lame and infirm, positions of a lesser amount. So yes, he is being made whole under the workers' compensation provisions, but he is not being made whole for the loss he has suffered from the work comp injury, which our statutory scheme in its entirety is intended to do for the worker.
Is this a case of first impression on this, on that exact point?
As far as I could find, we found no case law either in this state or other states that addressed this supplemental wage loss. I believe that Judge Anderson misinterpreted or misread the statute 62741. I think a clear reading of the statute suggests that it can be applied only to a claimant that is not totally disabled. Judge Anderson's decision then is not consistent. He's found on the one hand that Mr. Scheid is in fact permanently and totally disabled, but on the other hand that he does not fall within the parameters of this statute, or that he does fall, excuse me, within the parameters of 62741, which applies only to a person not totally disabled. The second problem with that statute as it applies to Mr. Scheid is that it's a benefit that is granted to an employee in lieu of rehabilitation. The evidence is undisputed in this record that Mr. Scheid was not a candidate for rehabilitation, was not qualified to be rehabilitated, and that if he went through a program of rehabilitation, it would not return him to the prior position that he had been in prior to this injury. So I can't be given a supplemental wage loss award in lieu of rehabilitation when I'm not entitled to rehabilitation. I can't be given a supplemental wage loss when I am not, when I am totally disabled, when it only applies to a party not totally disabled.
If we were to uphold this analysis of the law, what effect would this have? Because as I read 62.741, the employer makes the call, don't they? It says the employer may, in lieu of rehabilitation, require the employee to accept. So what would that do? How would that change, or would it change, the workers' compensation program?
I think it would change it substantially. I think it would then become, we would get into an argument on every single case where an employee is permanently and totally disabled and accepts some type of sporadic employment, or is in fact required to accept some type of sporadic employment, so the employer insurer then is entitled to the offset. It's like the case of the old chestnut where the piano player loses his hand. Certainly, he's not permanently and totally disabled from all employment of all type, but that's not what our scheme talks about. But he is permanently and totally disabled now from his usual and customary line of work. I think what this would do is it would force that piano player to go and accept a job in the convenience store, accept a job at McDonald's, because that amount of money, whatever amount of money he could make, whether it's $2,000 a year or $20,000 a year, would then be used to offset his workers' compensation benefits. And that is not what our statutory scheme provides for now, and it is not what our definition of permanent totally disability is. In our system, we are compensating people who are permanently and totally disabled from their usual and customary line of work. Our statute defines being permanently and totally disabled as not being able to go back to something where you can earn the equivalent of or greater than your prior wage. So here, and I think this is the reason this is such a hard argument, or it's such an appealing argument from the judge's perspective. Here we're so close, $39 away from his prior wage. We're almost at that equal to or equivalent to or greater than, but we're not quite there, and that's what our statute requires, is that we be there, that we be equivalent to. Now, the legislature has recognized that, and they've changed the statute since then, and they say now you have to be able to return the employee to 85% of his prior wage. And Mr. Scheid, clearly under that statute, because he earns 90% of his prior wage, would not be permanently and totally disabled. But that is not what the law says at the time Mr. Scheid was injured, and a clear application of the law is required in each case, as I understand it, so that we are all treated the same under the law. With regard to, if I may just briefly address the issue of whether or not Mr. Scheid was permanently and totally disabled, which is an issue raised by the employer insurer on the notice of review, I would point out to the court that not only did the department find after two hearings that Mr. Scheid was permanently and totally disabled, but that Judge Anderson affirmed that same finding without even any argument on the issue. And since that is a question of fact, and it's my understanding that then the standard for review by this court is whether or not that finding is clearly erroneous. Employer insurer argue that Mr. Scheid was not a credible witness. However, their attacks upon his credibility were not on issues that were material or relevant to the actual issue of his employability. And the fact is that the expert witnesses that were called to testify could not identify employment that was suitable, substantial, or gainful as defined by our statute, that were regularly and continuously available for Mr. Scheid and his community, which happens to be the peer community, on a regular basis, and that therefore he was, in fact, permanently and totally disabled. So with that, unless there are any other questions, I would ask that the court affirm Judge Anderson's findings with regard to the finding of permanent total disability and reverse Judge Anderson's ruling with regard to his application of SDCL 62-741 to Mr. Scheid's case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. McKnight, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, it's always a little bit difficult being the second one up because you're not really sure where things are going to go, and so I'm going to bounce around here maybe just for a minute before I start with my prepared argument. There were some good questions that were raised by the court of Ms. Myers. A couple things I'd like to point out. First of all, at the time that this service writer job with Capital Motors was offered to Mr. Scheid, the testimony was that the job paid between $7 and $7.50 an hour, but Mr. Bramley from the employer also testified that given Mr. Scheid's experience, they would probably pay him $8 an hour and it was 51 hours a week. So we're getting awfully close at that point. At the time, it actually was offered to him in September of 1999 to be in a job that would have paid him at least his workers' compensation benefit rate. Justice Sabers had a question, and I think Pat was mistaken in what she said in terms of the percentage. The return to work incentive is 20%, not 25%. And I wanted to point that out to the court. Lastly, Pat made mention of this being $39 a month difference. It's actually $39 a week. His comp rate is $408 a week, and it was $369 is approximately what he was making working for Bullwig Farms. Justice Meyer-Henry, you asked, I think, the most probative question here from a policy standpoint, and that was the question about what effect will this have on the workers' compensation system? And Pat's answer is that it's going to change it substantially. I submit that it would change it substantially for the better. And I think that's what Judge Anderson recognized, is that there should be an incentive here, and we ought to encourage workers to go back to work. Pat uses the example of the piano player. If this were the law, being now forced to go out and get a job at 7-Eleven rather than sitting around and just collecting work comp benefits, shouldn't that be the policy? Shouldn't we encourage workers to go back to work?
Wouldn't it be better, however, if you went back and got the law changed so that it doesn't say if an employee is not totally disabled, and change it so that it doesn't exempt a totally disabled person out of that statute?
Let me just try to put this in a little bit different perspective for the court, and bear with me because this is a little bit, you kind of have to walk through the history, I think, to see where this statute came from. 62-741 was enacted and became effective July 1 of 1995. 1 year prior to that, in July of 1994, the legislature had changed and adopted 52 and 53. 53 being sort of the codification of the odd lot doctrine, 52 adding some things and defining some terms, community and so forth. But what ended up happening there is really for the first time by statute or frankly by case law, under 53, it was defined that you were permanently totally disabled, even though you could work, if the work didn't pay you at least your work comp benefit rate. Now, I don't think that had been the law prior to that statute. So after 1994, then, you've got a situation where you've got an employer who could defend a perm total case really only on two grounds. Number one, by showing that the claimant can work at a job that pays them at least their workers' compensation benefit rate, or alternatively to be able to show we can rehabilitate you to get you back to doing something that's going to pay you at least your workers' comp benefit rate. Those were really the only two defenses available after the enactment of 52 and 53. Now, unfortunately, what you're faced with is you have many, many workers and many, many workers' compensation claimants out there who simply are not able to be rehabilitated. They have either a low education, they're older, they otherwise don't qualify, they don't do well on their GAPI tests, and so forth. So after 1994 then, with those people that had a high workers' compensation rate and couldn't be rehabilitated, you were stuck paying them full workers' compensation benefits for the rest of their life. And I think that's what the legislature realized and was trying to fix, admittedly maybe somewhat inartfully, in 1995 when they enacted 62-741. It now covered that gap. In other words, now you had a defense of, we can find them a job that pays them at least their work comp rate, we can rehabilitate them, or in lieu of rehabilitation, if we can find them some other job, we only have to pay them the gap. We don't have to pay them the full load. Justice Sabers, I think you asked the question or made the point. isn't this a windfall to the claimant? I submit that it absolutely is a windfall to the claimant. To have someone who's working, making $369 a week, drawing $408 a week in workers' compensation benefits, the math, as I do it, roughly gets Mr. Scheid making about $7,000 more a year than he ever made.
But isn't that a policy decision that should be made by the legislature?
I think the legislature did make that decision, Your Honor, and that's my point. I think 62.741 was the fix. Now, there was some discussion about, well, the statute starts out and it says if an employee is not totally disabled. Mr. Scheid is not totally disabled. He is working. He has been working. And he still is able to work.
But isn't he totally disabled? Isn't that what Judge, both the department and the trial court judge determined, that he was totally disabled under the workers' compensation
statute? He is deemed permanently totally disabled by reason of the statute for purely economic reasons. It is not a total disability in the sense that the doctors have said, look, you cannot work. There is nothing you can do. You are stuck. This is a purely an economic, if you will, permanent total disability. It is not a total disability in the sense of I'm physically unable to work. And in this case, there was no medical reason why Mr. Scheid couldn't work.
But in view of the present language of the statute, shouldn't it be the employer's responsibility and their lobbyists to go back to the legislature and get a more perfect elucidation of what the meaning was, unless it is that meaning?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think this court's responsibility is to look at the statutes and construe them, and I think that you can construe this statute in the same way that Judge Anderson did, and it would be appropriate. The statute does not say, and the legislature certainly could have said this, if an employee is not permanently and totally disabled under 62.453. They refer to it as total disability, and I submit to you that's total disability in the context of being medically incapable of working. I think 62.741 was the fix that came about after they had enacted 52 and 53 and realized there was this gap there. That's my interpretation of it, and you know, unfortunately we don't have legislative history in the state to confirm that, but it makes some logical sense. 53 imposes a requirement that wasn't there before. You now have this gap. We're going to fix it by enacting 62.741. It's in the claims procedure section, which to me means that it's more of a defense. That's where a lot of the other defenses are, notice and statute of limitations and so forth. And I think this was the legislature's attempt to give employers another defense in those situations where someone cannot be rehabilitated.
Isn't this in conjunction with the other rehabilitation statutes?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. There's some argument that's been made about the language of being unable to return to the employee's usual and customary employment. That language is also found in the rehabilitation statute, 62.45.1. But it's also found in the temporary partial disability statute as well. So it's not language that is confined or peculiar to the rehabilitation statute. That language is found elsewhere, and it's found in the context of the temporary partial statute. The temporary partial disability statute is somewhat similar to this statute, albeit on a temporary basis. And that statute says if you can't go back to your usual and customary line of work, but you can work and you can't make the same amount of money, you get one half the difference between what you were earning before and what you're earning now. I mean, it's almost as though this was the temporary partial statute fix, if you will, for the permanent total situation.
What about the argument then that the employee would not be compensated for the loss, which is the basis of the workers' compensation statute?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't know where that comes from, because I don't know that any workers' compensation claimant is ever compensated totally for the loss. You start with the proposition that someone gets 66 2/3% of their average weekly wage, so they're already behind the curve. And I don't think the work comp system ever compensates anyone totally for their loss. And on the flip side of it, why should Mr. Scheid be working then $369 a week, also drawing $408 a week from the workers' compensation insurance company?
Wouldn't this encourage the opposite of what you're trying to get to, that he would be better off than just taking his disability and not working?
Absolutely not, and I'll tell you why. It absolutely wouldn't, because if this is a defense, under my interpretation, and it's in the section that presents defenses, and if it's indeed the fix and it's indeed the defense for the employer, then if Mr. Scheid decides he's not going to work, we can require him to accept the supplemental wage. In other words, he only gets the difference between the job that was actually offered to him and his work comp rate, plus the 20% incentive. I think it does the opposite, and that's what Judge Anderson recognized, is that it actually encourages somebody to go back to work because you're giving them this 20% incentive to do so. And the in lieu of rehabilitation portion of that statute, I don't think defeats the argument either. This truly is in lieu of. It's instead of. There's no requirement. It doesn't say that we have to prove that Mr. Scheid is able to be rehabilitated before the statute applies. It says instead of. Well, this is instead of, and that's what Judge Anderson found. He can't go to school, so instead of sending him to school, we're going to do this. In our view, Judge Anderson's interpretation of the statute makes sense. We should compensate injured workers for the loss that they've suffered. And I think this court has said it many times, particularly in the context of retraining. We're not here to try to elevate anybody's station in life, which I think this does. When you have someone now who's making $7,000 a year more, not even considering tax ramifications, this court has said that a lot of times in that constant, in the context of rehabilitation claims, that we're not trying to elevate their station in life. We're compensating them for their loss. And Mr. Scheid's loss in this particular situation is $39 a week. The statute also says as an incentive to get him to take that job, we've got to pay him 20% more. And I think Judge Anderson's interpretation of that was entirely proper. I would like to address, though, the issues that we have raised by notice of review, because I also think that they're very significant issues with regard to work comp and the future of workers' comp in the state of South Dakota. Mr. Scheid lives in Harold, and Harold, as I recollect, is 40 or some odd miles away here from Pierre, small town.
32.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Driven through it many times.
There are not a lot of economic opportunities in Harold. There are not a lot of communities within 60 miles of Harold. It's not unlike a lot of small towns in the state of South Dakota where there's limited access to a labor market and there are limited jobs that are available within the labor market that the claimant may live in. We're blessed on both sides of the state, Sioux Falls and Rapid, where in defending a work comp case you can generally find more than one job for somebody. That's not the case in a lot of areas. The department ruled here as a matter of law, and I disagree with Pat's assertion that we're talking about a clearly erroneous standard here. I think this is a question of law. The department ruled as a matter of law that showing one job was out there just wasn't enough. And I submit to you that that's wrong. And I think that places an unfair burden upon the employer and the insurer in a lot of instances when you're defending cases in a lot of places in this state.
Well, Pierre, though, falls into his radius.
Pierre falls within his radius, and we had the service writer job that was clearly within his physical restrictions. There's no question about that. It was a job that he was eminently qualified to do. The testimony from the employer was, we really like this guy, and we want to get him to do this job. It fell apart, admittedly, in the translation. Could have been handled better by the employer. I don't think there's any question about that. To some extent, it was kind of like my two little girls, 10 and 8, kind of fighting with one another. Well, I'm mad at you because you didn't come and see me in the hospital, and well, I'm mad at you because you're not calling me back, so neither one of them are communicating. But the fact of the matter is that job was open. It was available on several occasions for Mr. Scheid. The testimony at the hearing from the woman who had been handling the job after they changed their pay structure was that it clearly paid in excess of his workers' compensation benefit rate. And he, in essence, just kind of thumbed his nose at him and didn't contact him and didn't follow through. Work comp's a two-way street. You know, the employer has certain obligations that they have to abide by, and I think the employee also has some obligations. In other words, the employee can't just sit and yeah, I know they're, I know I'm supposed to talk to them, but I'm not going to call them. I mean, that's not right. And I think the department's decision in that respect was wrong. I think it's also eminently unfair and frankly an impossible burden to have to show that a job is actually open on the day you have a hearing. I've been thinking about that for a long time. I mean, I don't even know how I'd go about doing that. The job market is very volatile. Jobs come open, employers can't hold them open. You have a hard enough time getting employers to cooperate with you to come and testify anyway, not your own client, I'm talking about other employers. But to try to say, okay, we're going to have a hearing in 6 months, so I'd really like you to keep that job open, that's impossible. And it's compounded by the fact that when the department construed regularly and continuously available, they construed that to mean, well, it not only has to be more than one job, but these other jobs also have to be open and available on the day of the hearing. I mean, I can't do it for one, let alone do it for three. And if that's going to be the law in the state, then the court should tell us so we all know what the rules are. But I'll submit to you, defending permanent total disability claims is going to be next to impossible. That is an insurmountable burden.
You're not asking for some kind of attorney relief bill, though, are you?
I'm not asking for an attorney relief bill. You know what I mean? And whatever direction this court happens to go with this case, and God knows there's plenty of directions this case could go, the court has said many times you have to show that a job is actually open and available and regularly and continuously available and so forth. I'd like some guidance. Tell us what that means. Open and available when? To me, in my mind, what it ought to be is open and available at some point in time during this process. In other words, it's not just a job that has never, during the whole course of this case, been open, but at least open at some point in the process. You cannot impose a burden on lawyers in this state to say that it's open and available on the day of the hearing, because that just it is just not going to happen.
Isn't it significant in this case, though, that the service writer's job was with your own employer?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's a very important fact, that it was with our own employer. I think that even that strengthens our argument that this is a good job for him.
Well, I understand that, but this being open, it might be one thing to try and prove that Morris Construction had it open, but this was your employer. They controlled that open position, didn't they?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but put yourself in the position of the employer. Now, certainly they've got a workers' comp case going on, but I can assure you that's not the top on the list of priorities for them. I mean, they've got to run a business, and they can't say, well, okay, we're going to have a hearing in January, and this job is open in January. Well, one, the job is open in January of 2000 or July of 2000, so we're going to just keep it open, not have anybody doing it. To heck with whatever effect this has on our business, because we've got this work comp here.
What period or time frame was it open?
It was initially open in September of 1999. It was open again in January of 2000. It was open in, I want to say, spring, early summer of 2000, June, July, somewhere in that time frame. And then again, it came open again after we had had the hearing. I believe it was after we had submitted briefs, but before a decision was made. We made a motion at that point to reopen. The department said, no, I'm not going to let you reopen the case. Well, then they come back and they say, well, you got to show a job's actually open and available on the day of hearing. I want to put on evidence that now the job is actually open again, but you're not going to let me do it. I mean,
each of these times it was open, did the employer go back and talk to this gentleman and say it's open and here's what we're going to offer you?
The first time it was open, it was clear it was offered to him. That was the time when it maybe did or maybe didn't pay him his work comp rate. Probably didn't pay him his work comp rate. That was September of 99. January of 2000, it was only open for a brief period. I can't remember offhand if there were conversations with Mr. Scheid. I know about that time he was working with the Volk rehab person. The spring of 2000 incident was when the service guy down there had the contact with the fiance that he knew worked across the street and said, hey, have Bill call me. And then he tried to follow up calling this guy. He's working as a farmhand. They didn't make contact. The last time that it was open post-hearing, Mr. Scheid admitted that he had some discussions with Mr. Brambley. He admitted he received the letter. The letter itself, if you've seen it in the record, also wasn't a model of clarity, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. But they just never followed through on, you know, consummating this relationship and having this discussion and getting him hired. So it wasn't a model of clarity from the employer standpoint, but the job was there, and I think that Mr. Scheid had some obligation to follow through. My time is up. If there's no further questions, I'll sit.
Thank you, counsel. Okay. Ms. Myers, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. If I could just follow up on something that Mr. McKnight said at the end, I think Mr. Scheid's testimony was, I've got a bird in the hand. I've got a job that's paying me well. I've got a job that the voc rehab people are telling me is at the high end of what my residual earning capacity is. I'm living in Harrell, South Dakota. They're coming to me with this job that may or may not pay me because it's all about commissions and possible bonuses. So it wasn't here, have the job, and this is going to pay you more than your comp rate. The other issue is, it wasn't, as I understand the court's ruling, a finding that you have to have a position open at the time of the hearing. I think both the Department of Labor and Judge Anderson, who didn't really get to that, talked about this job being one of two or three similar jobs in Pierre that would maybe be open occasionally because people tended to hold these jobs for 5 to 7 years. So it wasn't the kind of a job that was regularly and continuously available. And this was the only real job that employer insurer could even find that fit Mr. Scheid's residual capacity, his weight restrictions, his work limitations, and gave him a comparable wage. Mr. McKnight then talks about, with regard to the 762.741, that we should interpret the total disability in that statute as meaning medically incapable of working. Well, that's not in the statute, and SCCL 2-14-4 requires that where a definition is applicable to the same word or phrase, it is applicable wherever the word or phrase occurs unless a contrary intention is clearly stated. Now, this statute doesn't even come close to that. There's two kinds of disability under our workers' compensation code, temporary total disability, permanent total disability. So to say that totally disabled means something other than permanently or totally disabled and now implies that it means medically incapable of working, then the legislature should make that clear because that is a different standard. 62.453 defines what it takes to be permanently and totally disabled. And that's what Mr. Scheid is. Then Mr. McKnight kind of made this remark, I guess that startled me. Wouldn't it be better for us to make piano players go back and work in those convenience stores? Well, our comp rate maxes out. So even in Mr. Scheid's case, his average work, his weekly wage was more than the maximum comp rate. So while in Mr. Scheid's case, it seems like it may be working some kind of injustice on employer insurer to let Mr. Scheid work at another job, it still doesn't compensate Mr. Scheid completely for the loss he sustained. And this court recognized that. It's recognized it in the Cozine case, and it recognized it in National Farmers Union versus Bang, which is 516 Northwest 2nd, 331, where you held that his earnings are insubstantial, where his earnings are insubstantial is defined by SECL 62-4-53. We are compensating him for the loss of earning capacity, not the actual wage loss. Here, Mr. Scheid has, as would the piano player, has sustained a significant loss of earning capacity. Just so to say, I can work at a job where I can make $5 an hour when before I was making $15 an hour or $20 an hour, but my comp rate's maxed out by the legislature, doesn't actually compensate me. The legislature did address that problem. They may not have done it. They may not have gotten it to the place we want it to be, but they did it when they amended that statute and said, if I get you back to 85%, then that's close enough. That's good enough. That's equivalent. And that's how the legislature can address this problem again if it chooses to do so, by continuing to define what is in fact suitable, substantial, and gainful employment. Rather than being 85% equivalent to or greater than, it can continue to define that term. And that would be more appropriate than for this court to try and read in some new definition into 62.741. If there's nothing else, I thank the court for the time and appreciate your attention.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess.